drugs,
rights, quality of life,
recovery, harm reduction,
advocacy,
policy, treatment,
stigma,
Drugs Uncut, the Scottish Drugs Forum podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Drugs Uncut. My name is Wes Steele and I work primarily on peer-to-peer naloxone supply across Scotland, and we welcome Matt Southwell. You want to introduce yourself, Matt, please?
Yeah, hi Wes, my name's Matt Southwell. I'm the project executive of the European Network of People Who Use Drugs, and I also work for another organisation called COACT, which is a technical support agency.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much, and thank you for making the time to come and speak to me today. I wonder if you could just give a super brief background of your own journey, if that's okay, and some of the work you've been involved in and what leads you to kind of be here now. Is that right?
Yeah, look, so, I mean, I started off as one of the first generation of harm reduction workers in the UK. So I was at college in West Sussex when HIV sort of first was started to be talked about in the mid-1980s. And I ran a really terrible HIV campaign at my college, you know, coffins and you're all going to die, all this sort of really helpful stuff. And that also led me then to have a conversation with the Sussex AIDS helpline, which was one of the early HIV helplines run by the gay community. And that was really gay men organising together, and they taught me community mobilisation. So when I went into the drugs field and started working as a harm reduction worker in an East London hospital, I took that model of community organising. And by the time anybody realised what I was doing, it was being so successful that they endorsed me and carried on with that model. So then over the next 10 years, I set up an organisation called the Healthy Options Team, which was what we'd call a community-led harm reduction service, part of the NHS with traditional NHS employees, but also half the staff were drug users, first organisation to employ people on methadone in the UK and also active drug users. And that was a very successful programme. Through to the sort of end of the 1990s when drug policy started to change. And at that point in frustration, I decided to talk publicly about my own drug use. And so I fronted a TV documentary in 2001 on the BBC called Counterblast, which was a programme called Chemical Britannia. And I was the open drug user fronting a programme with three other drug users who had their faces covered. And we talked about our lives drug users and drug using culture. That led to me losing my job in the NHS, losing my consultancy company, so then I re-pivoted and started to then work for the drug user rights movement, working initially forming the UK network, then the international network of people who use drugs, and more recently the European network.
That's awesome. Thank you very much. Very colourful history, and thank you for your honesty and just even the vulnerabilities around talking about that first campaign and how it sounds like you went off and learnt from other people about how to deliver that kind of community-led campaign and stuff. That's really, really interesting. I'm going to Google the episode, see if I can find it, and I'll definitely go and watch that. So I've got a wee bit of a kind of topic guide, Matt, if it's okay to just run through some questions, open to expand on stuff, very informal, hopefully. And again, just, yeah, thank you for your time and coming along. I'd like to ask initially, if it's okay, to just get some of your thoughts about the possible differences between people with lived experience and people with living experience, and any experiences you've got from some of the work you've done internationally. I myself am a person who used to have that problematic substance use. I haven't used substances for a wee while now. Sometimes my attitudes or approaches might be slightly different to someone, or the experience I've got might be, dare I say, less relevant because of the time that's elapsed. So I'd just be keen to hear any of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, look, I think this breakdown between living and lived is a very UK phenomenon. It's not something that's really discussed outside the UK. And in the early work, we didn't really make this big separation. So, I mean, I think there was an acknowledgement that different people had different journeys around their drug taking. Some people chose to stop taking drugs. Other people were focused on harm reduction, on self-control. Also understanding that UNODC's, the UN Office of Drugs and Crimes, World Drugs Report, which comes out every year, would say that probably about 10% of people who use drugs have problems, what they would call substance use disorder, mm-hmm. and the other 90% are recreational, experimental or controlled users. So I think one of the challenges is that the drug using community is very diverse. The vast majority of people are using recreationally or in a controlled manner. And then there's a smaller group who then have problems. And of course, these groups are not totally different populations. People move in and out of those different worlds. But the vast majority of people are not having problems. And then a smaller group have problems. And then of that group, a smaller part then would see recovery as their pathway to using. Mm-hmm. Other people would see themselves as stopping using without necessarily taking on more the sort of ideological baggage of recovery. So for me, I learned from the gay community. So I saw this growth of LGBTIQ plus, so this evolving group of initials, which for me was an understanding that communities are diverse and that one of the ways that you need to mobilize effectively together is how do you mobilize across that diversity so that as a community that you can stand together. One of the things we learned very painfully back in the sort of period when the National Drug User Development Agency was organizing from about 1999 to 2004 was how the government manipulated us and turned methadone users against active drug users, turned cannabis users against ex-drug users. Now, there was this really clever manipulation to turn us against each other, and even turning very good friends against each other by using money and playing games with each other. So I think for me, we need to learn as a community how to stand with all of our diversity and complexity so that we can stand in solidarity with each other. At the same time, we then need to learn how to manage relevance. So what we call the idea of self-determination, so that we always try to make sure that the people who are speaking about a particular topic have the most relevant experience related to that. And if possible, that should be living experience, people who've got contemporary experience of that issue. But the reality is not, you won't always have the right, exactly the right person in the room to speak on the right topic. So that's also the value of a network. That, like, for example, if women who use drugs is the focus, and I'm there as a man who uses drugs, then of course I'm still going to advocate for women who use drugs, but I should be listening to the sisters in our movement to find out what I should be saying and how I should be advocating. So it's that sort of sense of we're a diverse community, we're at our most impactful when we can work together and stand in solidarity, and we try to have this principle of self-determination. So let's put the people who have the most contemporary experiences at the forefront of advocacy and representation.
That's brilliant. And that leads very well on to the next point, which I feel we've probably partially covered already. And it's just around why is the inclusion of living experience important? And it sounds from your previous answer like you can't underestimate the value of having a relevant network, I guess, for service providers, policymakers, stakeholders to be able to hopefully approach and tap into and allow the network potentially to provide an avenue for the best person placed, as opposed to, you know, the services or the stakeholders individually approaching an individual. Would you say that's a fair comment?
So look, I think the challenge is with living experiences that in the UK we've started to have this narrative about living and lived, and that's partly because the UK has seen this very politicized use of recovery. And I talk about the UK because it's very much a Westminster government phenomenon, and essentially it was an excuse to justify austerity. Now they were cutting the life out of our services and coming up with a reason for doing it, and they misused recovery to do it. Now I see many of my friends benefiting from the recovery self-help movement. Personally, it's not what I find helpful, but I see friends of mine, people who I was at HOT with, we worked together, peers of mine who I've organized with, who've got to the point where self-help is the self-help recovery is the right thing for them. And you can see why. No, it's NA or AA provides another form of community. So when you step away from the active using community, it gives you a chance to still be supported by a community. Now, setting aside the ideological differences, but you can see why that community support makes sense. I think what the problem was that there was also, alongside the government trying to use this very politicized identification of recovery, there was also a sort of, I suppose, the bit of the recovery movement that is most cultish in its obsessions around recovery and its most belief that recovery is the only way, which of course is not everybody in recovery by any means. that group also mixed up into this whole world and started to sort of take anti-methadone positions, anti-harm reduction positions, and started to say, look, essentially that group of active drug users, they're worthwhile talking to because eventually they might become like us and achieve recovery. Now, for those of us who are defending a human rights model of drug taking, we find that objectionable. We believe that our rights exist whether we choose to use drugs or not. We have a right to health, and we defend that right to health. So that's where in the UK the voice of living experience has become more and more significant. I have to say, around the world, a lot of our peers are looking at it as a slightly UK aberration. They don't quite understand why we have this issue. Mm. So for me, it's about meaningful representation, having the right people at the right tables talking about their own lived experience or living experience. But it's also how we find solidarity with each other, because we understand when the recovery movement and the active drug user movement are turned against each other, that only benefits one group, mm. and that's the policy makers. We need to find ways of standing together in solidarity so that we can fight for our diverse community.
It's almost quite tragic, and I think, it resonates with me, just this kind of people trying to move in a similar direction to improve outcomes for people who use or people who used to use, yeah. irrespective of where they are in that kind of timeline,
yeah.
And whether they want to move or not. And I feel like it detracts from the progress of the work streams that we're involved yeah. in and the narrative we're trying to kind of have with people. It's just such a shame, really.
And I think importantly what you're saying, Wes, is that you and I have made different choices around the trajectory of our drug taking. But in some level, that also speaks to the history of our drug use. Now, you've had a more challenging experience of drug use. Now, drug use took you into places that you didn't want to stay in.
Yeah.
Now, for me, drug use was always much more celebratory in my life. I've always seen it much more like a sort of extreme sport rather than a disease in that level. Now, I definitely had 3 years where I really got myself into a mess with drug use, I really experienced what substance use disorder experience is like, and that's very different from recreational drug taking. So I was not happy to experience that, but I felt it benefited me seeing those different experiences of drug taking. And I think you and I can stand in solidarity with each other and have an understanding of the support for drug treatment, for harm reduction, for community mobilisation, even though we make different choices personally around our drug use. And I think that's the difference between solidarity as people who use drugs and then the individual choices we make as human beings, which is hard to predict for where we'll be around our drug use in 5 years' time, 10 years' time. So it's likely to be changing and evolving. That's the nature of substance use in people's lives.
Definitely. And I think there's something about not being defined by previous use exactly. or choices of stepping forwards into whatever that may look like. And I think for me, I try very hard to keep an open mind to all aspects. I define recovery myself. My definition of recovery is any step towards healing. It has nothing to do with the cessation or reduction of substance use. It has to do with an improved outcome and an improved quality of life for the person as defined by the person. Yeah, I think this is where we often, or some voices in the arena can often fall short or give, that kind of paternal approach or aspect that we know what's best for somebody, they don't know what's best for themselves. And again, I think that just really detracts from, we're talking about human beings that have got a right to the highest quality attainable level of health, irrespective of their choices and things like that. Really interesting topic, really close to my heart. And I'd just be interested if I could ask you to talk about examples of good practice models around paying people who use drugs to be involved, things like community development, community-led initiatives, and research, and again, trying to tap into your experience and expertise internationally.
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting topic, Wes, and it's a topic we really struggle with. I mean, I've been a big advocate of paying people who use drugs for our expertise. Now, if you want to take our time, and you want us to step out of active drug use and raising money for active drug use and to take time to take part in a piece of research or to contribute to a development process, then I think it's reasonable to pay for that expertise. We would expect that as staff members, as other people. However, there are some practical challenges around paying people. I mean, for some people, it poses ethical issues. Oh, my God, I'll be paying people and they're going to spend it on drugs. For me, I think we all choose. You know, I mean, if you get given a salary, I don't think your employer asks you to tell them what you spend that salary on. If you choose to spend it on McDonald's rather than a healthy organic potato, then the employer doesn't come and say to you, "Hey, where's surely you should be eating a more healthy option." We accept that we pay people for their time, and then people choose to make choices around how they spend that money. We know that actually from Carl Hart's work, that when you give people cash, people don't always rush out and spend it on drugs. People do make choices to spend it on food, to have different options. But it is their right to make choices how they want to spend the money that they have earned. So I think for me, I'm left thinking very carefully about money. I pay people, or we pay people, for delivering certain functions. So if you deliver a survey, you take part in a focus group, you take part in a peer training, those are things where you're either giving knowledge across or you're gathering expertise that you then take back out into the community, what we call life outreach. So I think those things for me are worth paying for. You're boosting people's engagement. What I'm less comfortable about, and what I think is less effective to pay for, is to pay people to turn up to peer meetings. What happens then is that people learn that the reason to turn up is to get the money, not to do the organising. And then what happens is the really motivated people stop coming because they get frustrated that the people who turn up and are people looking for the tenor, not the people looking to do real organising. And then it starts to detract over a period of time. So I think not to incentivize people to meet per se, but to incentivize people for behavior that you want to see. So like taking on training, sharing intelligence, delivering a particular research, peer research project. That's what I would pay for, not paying for the basic activities of organizing, because otherwise you end up with this sort of, it becomes all the good people start moving away. All the people really who are driven by the tenor is the most important thing. That group start to dominate, and then it really undermines organising. So I don't have the right answer around this one. It's something that we're constantly refining and changing. Sometimes coming in and paying people money to do incentive programs causes huge friction in the service. It also creates issues around sustainability. But I still don't think that's an excuse not to pay people. I think we've got to work out how we do it. Where do we pay people? What's the moment to pay people? And then we also need to think about that payment is the beginning of the engagement. Then it's more about career development. It's about proper induction. It's about proper career development opportunities. That should become the longer term journey. The peer payments is the entry to that journey. If that's the only place it goes, then peer payments start to become more significant. For me, that's the beginning of a journey that should then lead on to a much more substantial, structured process of peer development.
That's really interesting. It sounds almost like if I want someone to contribute to the work I'm doing or to be able to tap into their experience and expertise, then yes, I should justifiably pay them for their time and their expertise and their experience. Whereas if people are wanting to organise, and it sounds to me like they want to take ownership of the organising they're doing, then not necessarily paying them is the way to go, if that makes sense, because they're organising for themselves. And I think there's some empowerment and ownership kind of that would come with them not being paid or being incentivised to kind of meet. I feel like you've probably covered some of this, but I had a question around what are the key principles and practicalities of paying people? What are some of the challenges or ways to overcome challenges? Say, for example, a service or a worker in a service wanted to incentivize people, but they were coming up against challenges. Any tactics or techniques or things to consider that might help them kind of sell that idea to the powers that be, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah, so I think three key tips I would say is, firstly, give people cash, not vouchers. If you give people vouchers, you end up just creating problems for yourself. First, you make the voucher worth less money, because immediately what people will try to do is, or those people who want to access the money in cash, they will then try to sell the voucher. We had this in Bath, where we had problems with Boots, where the chemist was then seeing drug users standing outside the chemist trying to sell their vouchers to other people, other customers. of course, the voucher then is less money because you've got to sell it to give people an incentive to buy the voucher off you. So immediately you've reduced the value of the incentive. You're then creating hassle with the boot security staff who are then having to deal with these drug users, you know, causing hassle as the security staff would see it outside outside their pharmacy. And I think that's the sort of more practical process. I think then it's just about being clear. Why are we giving out payments? Where does the payment have impact? Okay, I'm taking knowledge off you. I'm rewarding you for that. Okay, I'm asking you to take on board some knowledge so that you can have skills to take back into your community. So I'm really strategically thinking about, why am I incentivizing you to do this? What is it I'm trying to get you to engage in? If we get to the point where the only reason people will turn up is because of an incentive payment, that in itself becomes problematic. So one of the ways of trying to get people to think about it is organize together, mobilize together, then you attract the opportunity to run maybe a support don't punish activity with EuroEMP in June. Maybe it gives you a chance to join the Women in Harm Reduction International Network campaign on the elimination of violence against women who use drugs in November and December. Maybe it gives you a chance to take part in a research project and get your peers earning some money, and maybe your peer leaders earn some money by running the focus group. The key is to start thinking, as we mobilise our drug user group, then we start to make ourselves available for those types of activities, and then we bring money into our group, and maybe individual people get paid to deliver certain functions. It's the active drug user group that draws in and attracts that support. So I think it's that sort of getting people to understand that it's this creation of a drug user hub that attracts opportunities that you as a drug user group can follow through.
Almost like a pool of skills and expertise and opportunities for people. And I know some of the work we're involved in, some of the peer naloxone work that I've been involved in, there were sessional payments available for people in the community project. Some people opted not to do that. And I'm always keen to try and encourage, you know, access to skills training and development and see where people want to take it. It's not always about, you know, paying people. It's about catering to the needs and offering opportunities for people that are there and kind of available. I know the peer research team are involved in a national MAT observational study at the moment where they follow people in their treatment journey for up to 6 months, and they actually get a monthly payment for being involved in that study. And I think for me, you know, we're asking to get some insight and a sneak peek into what can be quite a challenging and difficult experience for people to undergo. Mm-hmm. We're asking them to share that with us. So I think not only as an incentive to them to be involved and stay involved, but also a bit of an acknowledgement of some of the stuff that they're potentially sharing with us. You know, we shouldn't be asking people to disclose all that stuff and share all that stuff kind of for free. Really interesting discussions. Some of the other stuff that, you know, we've been aware of is the engagement groups that SDF chair and kind of facilitate people transitioning from being members to co-facilitating and then wanting to access some additional training. And I think, you know, the vision of that is that then they can kind of become constituted and take on their own kind of autonomy, for want of a better phrase. We've had people undertake SVQs and then move on to paid roles where they wanted to do that. Similar in the kind of naloxone work, you know, peers progressing into full-time employment. So I'd like to ask what your thoughts are around good practice relating to payment for specific peer roles. And I think I see quite often some disparity with similar roles and responsibilities. And then sometimes if as a kind of peer in the job title, maybe it's not paid or reimbursed at the same level as a non-peer role. Mm-hmm. So I'd be keen to just try and get some insight.
Yeah, look, I mean, one of the things I would encourage listeners to look out for is something called the Global Peer Work Consultation. And this was something run by Medecins du Monde, IMPUD, EuroEMPUD, and then the European Regional Sex Worker Network. And we ran together a consultation where we ran 15 focus groups with drug using and sex worker peer workers in, I think it was 15 focus groups in 12 or 13 countries around the world. And then we brought, you know, big donors and governments NGOs together to hear the feedback from all these different focus groups of peer workers saying, look, how remarkable they found the opportunities, how much they appreciated the chance to be contributing to their community, but also some of the frustrations. They're watching students coming in with far less expertise than them, but then coming in and getting paid jobs while they're still sitting there on far less well-paid peer work roles. Often the roles that take far more risk on a front line. So people right at the front line working in a much more high-risk settings, but often not being remunerated for that role or not being properly remunerated for that role. People seeing other people getting far more professional development opportunities than them, not getting the chance to progress. And so again, it just feels like, you know, you expect us to take on a lot of the challenges of the work, yet you're also not so willing to take on the responsibility for looking after us. So for example, now, one of the things we highlight is that working with active drug users can be a bit messy. No, it can be challenging at times. People will fuck up on their drug use. People will have problems and issues in their lives. Now, you can either sit there and say, well, we insist that you have a 2-year drug-free period or a 5-year drug-free period or whatever it takes to somehow pretend that these problems are not our responsibility. But that's just ignoring the fact that you're asking people who use drugs to work in active drug scenes to benefit the wider system. You have a responsibility that if you're asking people to take on that additional risk, then they need additional support. You can't then turn around and say, oh, well, I asked you to go into this active drug scene. I see you've ended up struggling with your drug use. Maybe your drug use is becoming more more prolific at this point. I've even seen peer workers who have to use drugs, because if you don't inject drugs in front of the local drug dealers, they won't let you back into that drug scene. So I've seen people on methadone who actually don't experience their drug use at all, but every now and again, they just have to inject to show that they are really drug users and are therefore acceptable into those spaces. Now, that's the type of challenges that professional drugs workers are not having to manage. Now, you're not having to work in a sort of criminalized environment where you have to demonstrate where your credibility as a drug user is your pass for safely working in those environments. So I just think it's not reasonable to turn around to people and say, we ask you to work in this soft and messy world using your peer expertise, but we're going to be super rigid and hard about how we manage it in that world. That's not fair. It's a messy world. Peers are brokering that world. They're what we call bridge builders into that world, and therefore we need to hold and validate them. Like in Myanmar, for example, 2 drug users went to jail for 2 years each for just giving out needles and syringes as part of the peer work program. Now, that's a level of risk that we as a community take because we care for our community. Let me give you another example. I was supervising one of our peer workers, outreach workers from the Bridge Hope Health Organization in Afghanistan. After the return of the Taliban, this drug user was hit in the face with a rifle butt by the Taliban security officer. I was interviewing him afterwards, talking about how he was with a greatly visible black eye. And I said to him, look, brother, Reza, who is the guy's name, a very brave drug user activist. And I said to him, look, Reza, do you want to carry on with this work? And he said to me, well, if I don't carry on, who gives needles and syringes to my brothers and sisters? Mm-hmm. And I think that sense of loyalty, that sense of commitment, we have a responsibility to hold those people and treat them with dignity and respect as our key agents, getting needles and syringes to people that we otherwise would not reach.
And it sounds like, as much as we were talking about the payment and the disparity in payment, what I'm hearing and what I see, I guess, from some of my own experiences, is it's about offering that appropriate level of support and acknowledgement of the difficulty we ask some peer workers to undertake.
Yeah.
And that comes at a cost to them, at a cost to the service, at the cost to the friends and family of the people, themselves, I guess. It's not easy work. Some of the most impassioned and motivated people I've ever worked with are people who are using or have been using substances to help improve outcomes for people in their own communities. Yeah. And I think we don't necessarily always acknowledge or put adequate support measures in place for those people, which I think is, it's tragic. And I think it's really quite shameful. We want to utilize the expertise and the reach and the access that we've been talking about. But we don't always resource it adequately in terms of, the non-financial support that kind of needs. What do you think we could do better? What do you think needs, so it's, you know, hypothetical, say I'm a service looking at recruiting some peer workers or some living experience workers to help improve things in the local community. What do I need to take on board and put in place to give that the best chance of being effective for the people I'm trying to reach, but also for the people that are taking on those roles?
So I think the first thing is to understand, so one of the things that I'm doing as I go around the world as this sort of very wise international technical advisor is, of course, you're bringing in the knowledge from the global community, but then you're applying it into the local setting. So whenever I work with a group of drug users in a different context, yes, there are general principles, there are general interventions, there are general processes and strategies that, you know, we apply and that we know that they work. But we always understand that people have local expertise, local understandings of how their drug scene works, so that, yes, I'm having a conversation with people and saying, look, this is what people have done in other settings. How might it work in your setting? Okay, people have tried that. Do you think that would work? Okay, it's not going to work because of that. What else could you do? So that it's always this exchange between what is the good practice that we think works versus how do you apply that in a local context? So let me give you an example. Last week I was at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, which is the big UN meeting that defines the war on drugs. Now, many of your listeners might have heard of this horrific war on drugs that's been taking place in the Philippines, where ex-president Duterte endorsed essentially the summary execution or the extrajudicial killings of people who use drugs. 25,000 drug users have been summarily executed. So people on mopeds with a pinion rider pulling up behind someone and shooting them in the back of the head. People being grassed up as drug users and then being shot and killed. In the midst of that, there is a drug user group called I Do Care. And Panky and his team are giving out needles and syringes through peer networks, doing Hep C testing and treatment, running a women's support group, are doing just remarkable work of keeping a drug using community going, distributing healthcare to their community, even while the authorities are trying to execute and kill them. And those same drug users are sitting in bilateral meetings with the Ministry of Health, with other officials. And you know, these contrary things where you have security and health being managed at the same time, I think it's about really trusting those drug users and understanding that, yes, how do we equip you? How do we give you the support? How do we back you up? But also trusting people. Now, these people understand their own networks. Mm. Now, with the adequate support and training, with the right backing, people do remarkable things. I mean, I can pick at so many different drug user groups around the world. Kenyan drug users now operating as the broker to the healthcare system. So being the case managers that help people on OAT, people with HIV or hepatitis, engage in the system, being the people who come up and say, I see you've not been in for a while. Is there anything else you need? But having your peers doing that, not some sort of social worker or other doctor who may feel somewhat distanced from you as a person who uses drugs. So I think it's just, as we look around the world, Nigeria implementing its needle and syringe program pilot exclusively through drug user groups. And I think as we start to see those examples around the world, it just makes you think, if they do it in the Philippines, if they're doing it in Afghanistan, if they're doing it in Gombe State in Nigeria, if they're doing it in all these high-risk settings, what's stopping us?
My heart goes out to the people and some of the challenges they face. And, you know, lose sight of some of that stuff internationally sometimes, if I'm honest, and kind of be focused on the struggles and the progress we're trying to make here in Scotland. But, you know, some people have got it really, really difficult and are just so courageous for people to still be involved in that level of activism with the possible consequences that kind of loom over them. And it sounds to me like, you know, the early consultation and collaboration before initiatives even get up and running could really pay dividends rather than, you know, we've created this project or we've written a proposal and we're going to deliver this X, Y, or Z intervention. Let's now go and talk to people who are going to be accessing it and see what they think about it.
Yeah.
We need to be rewinding that and really having people at the table right at the get-go, at the kind of inception of ideas to make it more more effective and appropriate and acceptable to the people we want to come and access it. And it doesn't sound like rocket science, but I think it's something we could do a lot better here in Scotland and the rest of the UK.
Yeah, look, we've got a really good example in terms of in Bath, where I now live, the last 12 years. Now, we saw, we had a few using houses in Bath, which was known, like people who let their houses be used as places where you could buy and sell used drugs. And these existed for a while. They got closed down by the police, but they existed for a while. And as the COVID pandemic was unfolding, we were having conversations. We could start to see that there was this, I think, a very poor decision in the UK not to treat harm reduction as an essential service. So harm reduction was closed down like much of the other social health care. Other countries, Germany, other places, sustained their harm reduction services. Now, we uniquely in the UK have seen this loss of coverage by about 25 to 50% coverage because people stopped giving out needles and syringes. People stopped picking up as many needles and syringes during the pandemic, during the lockdowns, and then that hasn't gone back up again. Now, Bath, we started to look at this situation. Local providers were saying they were going to have a coffee table out in the street outside the drug agency, open two afternoons a week. Now, we thought, which drug users are going to remember which afternoons a week it's open, let alone which drug users want to stand in the street and pick up their needles and syringes? So we started sitting down with other drug users, with the local drug suppliers. And so we offered, and myself as someone who's got a background as a drugs worker, I then offered to broker with the local drug service so that we now give out about 60 to 80% of the local needles and syringes, about 1,500 needles and syringes a month, going out through about 10 to 15 peers. Each one of them then gives needles and syringes on to another four or five other people. So now we've lobbied with that service, that with our local services, that they should now invest $2,500 a year to actually run a peer training program. At this point, we still can't get them to commit to that because they feel it would incentivize drug taking and all of these other stories. At the same time, people seem to be missing the fact that we've had this remarkable initiative where we've got up to almost 100% coverage in one area of the country, while every other area of the country seems to be having this huge loss of coverage. There's one bunch of drug users and drug suppliers have turned the situation around and done quite the opposite. Yet it doesn't seem to be getting that great attention. And for me, this is why peer-to-peer works, because it's just quietly effective. Now, we can do things that other people just can't do. In Bath, by making sure that the key drug suppliers all give out needles and syringes, people are getting their needles and syringes as they buy their drugs or as they use their drugs. It's much more logical.
Coverage at point of need.
Absolutely.
As opposed to having to then go somewhere else to go and collect your equipment. Exactly. And we've just seen very recently a development with the first peer-to-peer needle and syringe provision here in Scotland, in Edinburgh. There's a bit of a response to the shift and in increase in people injecting powder cocaine now up in Scotland. And I would love to see that grow and expand and cover, because I know we've got a massive shortfall in the number of equipment going out versus what people are actually using. That's brilliant, Matt. Thank you. I'd hope you might tell us a wee bit about the good practice guide that you're involved in authoring. I think that's a really interesting document. I send it around quite regularly when I'm having conversations around employing people in the field. So just, a bit of background on that would be really useful.
Yeah, so there was a really great resource called Harm Reduction Works, which was written by two Canadian drug user activists called Raffi Balin, who sadly died of an overdose in the North American overdose epidemic, and his partner at the time, Cheryl White. They wrote this initial resource called Harm Reduction Works, which tried to sort of put an exposition of the ability of people who use drugs to be key employees, and it was a very formulative piece of work. And it went out to this, it was shared by this big harm reduction agency called Frontline AIDS, which is a big UK-based HIV response, but in international development settings. And Frontline AIDS had shared with its staff this sort of exposition of working around harm reduction. And lots of people came back with practical questions. They came back and said, yeah, that's great, but what happens if this? But that's fantastic, but what happens if this? So we came up with this guide together that the first half basically says, how do you create an empowering workplace for people who use drugs? And then the second bit says, if people get into problems or we have issues, what do we do? So it's a troubleshooting mm-hmm. section. And we just gathered, firstly, the learning from the Healthy Options team, the agency I first set up in the UK. I thought it was a very radical document when I first wrote it. And then all my peers around the world came in and said, no, that's far too conservative. Why are you doing that? Let's change this. And this great collaborative piece of work that it became something more than it started out to be. We also had sort of regional meetings with the frontline aides, bringing people together from Indonesia, from India, from Europe, from different places to look at practice. And then together, the idea is that this resource will evolve and grow. It's called the Good Practice Guide to Employing People Who Use Drugs. I'm really, really happy with it as a resource. I go back to it and look at it and realize how contemporary it remains, despite the fact I think it was written possibly 10, 15 years ago now as a resource. Mm. But very practical. And what we hope is it's a guide that supports people who are trying to create good practice. And we hope that it creates a conversation that allows other people to start sharing into that journey and moving it forward. I ran a drug service in the UK for 15 years. And by the end of it, half my management team were drug users. 25% of all my staff were drug users. This was 7 drug teams, including drug treatment agencies. And it was notable how many nurses, psychotherapists, other people, doctors even, who would come and say, I want to work in a service where, even though I can't tell everybody I'm a drug user, at least my boss knows I'm a drug user and I can be here because I celebrate the fact that this is an inclusive employer. Yeah. And having an agency that could actually, for at least 16 years, was a place where we celebrated people who use drugs. And it was not an accident that the Healthy Options team at East London and City Drug Service did some of the pioneering work around Hep C prevention, around crack cocaine, around heroin chasing, around route transition interventions, because that's what community-led organisations do. We're at the forefront of changing practice. So if you employ us and engage us, you help the system connect with the drug-using system. And that's this function of bridge building.
That's really interesting. I know there's some work underway with a workforce expert delivery group as part of the Scottish Government, drafting some guiding principles for employing people with experience, lived or living experience of substance use. So I think things are moving in the right direction. Yeah. I often wonder to myself how many professionals are out there that have got experience, you know, former or current, around substance use that don't or aren't able or comfortable to disclose. Yeah. Really interesting.
And I think it's really that key thing around having an honest dialogue about our drug use. I was on methadone for a couple of years, having managed my own form of safe supply for a long time through drug diversion. But during the pandemic, I had 2 years of being on OAT. And it was a really uncomfortable experience. I really found it very difficult talking to drugs workers who were quite punitive in their approach. My worker was obviously someone from a Narcotics Anonymous background, but he somehow felt he wasn't allowed in the rules of the organisation to talk to me about the fact that he was a drug user. And it just creates this tortured process of communication where, look, I don't need to know the intimate experience of this guy's life, but the idea that he can't even acknowledge that he's a member of my community in talking to me as a community member seems bizarre. Mm-hmm. No, it's just so much them and us. But I just think it's about saying, no, why can't we just be us? No, why do we have to be so lost in this thing? I mean, you and I have very different experiences of our drug taking, which leads us to be in different places around our drugs work, while having very common principles about how we think the work should be done. I mean, our life journey and our work don't have to be so locked that we can't have flexibility to apply our thinking differently from our experience. And I think, you know, working in the fact that drug use is highly complex. You know, this is a very complex model. If anybody tells you they have the answer to drugs and they've got the simple solution, this person doesn't know about drugs.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree, definitely. So cocaine and crack use is continuing to rise in Scotland. We've seen massive shifts in the kind of way that it's used and even the people that are using it. So I would love to hear more about your recent work with Professor Magdalena Harris on the Crackpipe Project. And if you could expand a wee bit on how did community involvement work and how were people who use drugs involved and what did that look like and what were the benefits of having their involvement?
Right. So one of the areas that my special interest is stimulant use, because I'm a stimulant user among other types of drugs. And definitely stimulants was how I came into drug use particularly. So I've always had a real interest in stimulants. I helped write the UNODC, UNAIDS, WHO guidelines on stimulants and HIV with a group of other community-led experts. And I've been very much going around the world trying to champion progressive response to stimulants, which in our country is cocaine and crack cocaine, but also in other countries is methamphetamine or cathinones, MPS stimulants. So I think there is a growing sense that we need to come up with, as much as we're clear about how we respond to people who inject drugs, we've also now got a very real clarity about what are the interventions we should be doing with people who use stimulants. And what we've seen in North America particularly, but also in other countries like Indonesia, for example, where we're seeing people using the distribution of crack pipes or stimulant pipes, meth pipes or cathinone pipes, as a prevention tool, to actually directly allow people to have a tool that helps them avoid the risk of hepatitis, the risk of COVID, the risk of tuberculosis or just flus and cold viruses. But it also is a key engagement tool. So Mark Kinsley, who's a lovely man who first came up with the idea of crack pipes in New York back in the 1990s, another community member we sadly lost in the recent years. But Mark told me a story about how he was giving out needles and syringes for Yale University, for the public health department, as part of a trial into needle and syringe programs. And as they were giving out needles, they walked past people smoking crack. And eventually Mark started to give out pipes. And he said the reaction from drug users was to suddenly go, "Now you've noticed us." No, so it was just this moment. And he said, suddenly we could work with people around their healthcare issues. We could work with them around their substance use. We could work with them around their housing. That crack pipe engagement created this moment of engagement. Now, North America's been doing this for 20 years. UK has stubbornly refused to go down the path of crack pipes for some reason. And Professor Magdalena Harris from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine has been an amazing champion of this piece of work. Magdalena has pulled together an incredible expert group of people from Bristol University, from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, from a whole range of provider groups across England, and has just done this really beautiful study to demonstrate the value of distributing crack pipes, both as a prevention tool and as an engagement tool. And the results are absolutely stunning. I mean, we're bringing people into services we've never seen before. We're getting people to engage in healthcare issues they've never talked about before. We start to really understand the underlying mental health, lung health, soft tissue issues, all these issues being faced by this population that have just been left on the street unattended. And there's huge areas of intersection, street drinkers using crack cocaine, injecting heroin users using crack cocaine, people just smoking crack on its own, people snowballing. I mean, just huge complexity. But targeting this population especially and targeting them with the drug using community is such a pleasure to go onto the street and work with crack users and for them to go, wow, someone cares about us, we're being treated as a special population that matters. Mm-hmm. And Magdalena deserves every credit for being such a champion in this area of work.
It just makes me think of this phrase, hard to reach, and then just, providing something that there is a need for and a want for and that people need to access. It sounds like they will come flooding once you provide and cater to that need. So they're not hard to reach. We're not necessarily providing what it is they're looking for. And when we start to provide it, they come along. I'd just like to ask quickly if you can expand a wee bit on the community involvement in that work and what that kind of looked like and how you went about providing this novel intervention that has not been kind of seen before.
Yeah, so look, one of the things Magdalena is, that I think anybody who knows has heard Magdalena speak will hear that she speaks about her own history as someone who injected drugs in the past as being one of the driving factors that's led Magdalena into her academic career fighting for the rights of people who use drugs. So just thinking about from the more community perspective, so one of the things that Magdalena asked me to do is to be the principal investigator for the community section of the study. So to really have a component that really looked at not just how do we engage people through drug services, very important though that is, but how do we also match that with community-led distribution? So for example, in Bristol, alongside Bristol Drug Project giving out 1,600 crack pipes over the course of the study, myself and Nick, a local peer worker, we gave out about 500 or 600 pipes on an outreach basis. So not on a regular basis giving out, but going out and doing surges of distribution, literally walking the streets and saying, hello, are you a crack user? And stopping people in the street and giving them out needles and syringes. So giving out crack pipes, engaging people, running surveys, talking to people. And then we've also done that work in Nottingham as well. Magdalena and I were recently up there engaging peers through community networks. And the difference of that is it just gets you into a different part of the population. People maybe not using services, or people who would see themselves as being on script, but not really that much engaged in the treatment apart from getting a script. So, and also people having quite prolific health issues. I mean, no chest problems, problems with soft tissue damage, skin picking that's become infected, lots of quite profound issues that we know how to respond to. That's the thing is, as drug services, we know how to respond to these issues. But people are sitting on the street with these issues not coming in, and crack pipes become the thing that brings people in. It's the engagement tool.
I just like to say, come on, Scotland, what are we waiting for?
Exactly. Yeah, look, I mean, I think Scotland has been such, I mean, I have to acknowledge, while we battle with the Westminster government to even be heard and are engaged by this Tory government who just, have just done so much systematic damage to our public sector and have undermined our model of drug treatment and harm reduction. I go around the world as a technical consultant teaching the famed British model of drug treatment. And it is so frustrating that we don't have it in the UK anymore. But I'm super happy to see Scotland picking up the baton, having discussions around human rights of people who use drugs, talking about decriminalisation, heroin-assisted treatment, drug consumption rooms. And I really would encourage the Scottish government, all power to you, carry on down this road. Don't let the Westminster government detract you from this path. Scotland is really doing something pretty unique and exceptional in the UK right now to champion how drug policy and practice should be going forward.
I think that's a really good note to leave it on, Matt, if you're happy with that. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise, mate.
And thank you again for your time and sharing your experience and expertise.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with myself and Matt Southwell. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like it, subscribe and share it. Thanks for listening and see you next time.